Hey, Mujer, it's Micaela, host of the Fearless Mujer podcast. What is the Fearless Mujer? It is a space for the mujer who ever felt rejected, misunderstood, and without a seat at the table. If you are ready to renew your mindset, let go of old versions that no longer serve you, and you're ready to be inspired to fearlessly pursue the dreams on your heart, then I invite you for a virtual cup of cafecito. You can listen to the Fearless Mujer on Spotify, Apple, iHeartRadio, and wherever you podcast.
What's up, Scaredy Cats? We hope you guys are having an amazing day today. Our names are Sway and Liz, and we'd love to welcome you to the Scaredy Cats podcast, where we kind of talk about all things scary, such as true crime, the paranormal, dark history, conspiracy theories, and much more. So if you find any of those things interesting, all you have to do is add us to your favorites, sit back, grab some snacks, and relax as we talk about some of the most bone-chilling and mysterious stories on planet Earth.
We also review the latest scary movies. If you have any stories you'd like us to talk about, feel free to send those in at our social media pages, at the Scaredy Cats and at Scaredy Cast with the K, or you can also submit all your stories to the email provided in the description of this episode.
And before we continue on with today's story, we do want to mention we are going to be hosting a live podcast event at the Magic Valley Mall on October 28th around 1 p.m. We will be doing that, as well as the grand opening of like this place called Magic Rock City, which is super cool because it's like a crystal shop. If any of that sounds interesting to you guys should definitely go. It's going to be super fun. We're going to be telling the story of Robert the Doll. Now, this doll is said to be more powerful than Annabelle, which is super scary. Honestly, doing the story is like the perfect timing for Halloween and stuff. So if you guys want to maybe meet us, or maybe even just come to the live event just for fun or do some kind of spooky activity, we'll be there at the Magic Valley Mall here in Twin Falls, Idaho at 1 p.m. on October 28th.
Today's story is intended for mature audiences. It will contain graphic descriptions of the case, so listeners' discretion is advised.
Now, with all that being said, today's story does take place in April of 1971 in Washington, D.C. And on this day, April 25th, a Sunday evening, as Carol Denise, one out of the eight sisters, was inside of their house playing around with their identical twin sister when their mom walked in and said that she was going to go down the street to meet with the family member. She told them to stay inside the house and not to open the door for anyone. Now, they said okay, and their mom leaves, but just a few minutes after, someone starts knocking. And both Carol and all of her sisters look at each other, but the knocks begin to get louder and louder. Carol decides to peek through the curtain and notices it was their older sister, who doesn't live with them anymore, knocking at the door. One of the sisters opens up the door for the older sister, and she ends up asking if one of them can go to the store with her to pick something up. Now, Carol says, "No, mom told us we cannot leave the house." So they close the door on her and she starts knocking again. They ignored her, but she then starts knocking really, really hard. So Carol gets up, opens the door, and tells her sister, "Okay, I guess I'll go to the store for you." So she ends up walking to a 7-Eleven gas station, which is about a mile away from their house. And I mean, like, I remember like when my parents were like, "Don't open the door for anyone unless it's like me, you, or that," and when we hear like knocks on the door, I would freak out. Yeah, so I can only imagine them. But if it's their older sister, I probably would have been like, okay, it's my sister.
Yeah, but it's like, even if you're the older sister, you don't live with them anymore, why are you sending your little sister to go to the gas station for you when you can do it yourself?
That is very true.
But as Carol was walking to the store, her mom ended up seeing her and she got very upset. She told her, "Didn't I tell you not to leave the house?" So Carol explains why she's out, and her mom's like, "Okay, I'll watch you from here to make sure you go into the 7-Eleven store, but you better get home afterwards." Once Carol got in the 7-Eleven, her mom started walking where she said she was going to. 30 minutes go by and the sisters at the house start wondering, why hasn't Carol gotten back yet? Like we said, this gas station was about a mile or so away from their house, so it shouldn't take her that long to get back. So all the sisters go around asking the neighbors if they have seen Carol, and all of them said no. They then go down to the 7-Eleven, and the cashier there knows the family pretty well because they would go there and buy stuff all the time. So they ask the cashier if he has seen Carol, and he says, "Yeah, she was in here a few minutes ago. She got a few stuff and then left." So they're like, "Oh, maybe she took a different path than she usually does, and she's probably already at the house." So they walk back to the house and she is nowhere to be seen. So about an hour goes by and their mom comes back home and notices that Carol is gone, and she starts asking, "Where's Carol?"
Then all the kids had a worried look on their faces, and they said she hadn't been back since she left to get the stuff for their older sister. They told their mom that they went house to house asking, and that they went to check the store and she wasn't there. The mom quickly picks up the phone and calls calls 911 to report Carol as missing. When she got on the phone with someone and explained what was going on to the police, they told her that Carol probably just ran away. And they tell her that she just can't do anything about it. It hasn't been more than 24 hours to do like a, you know, file a missing person. So the mom knew that there was no way in heck her daughter would do that, and she wasn't the kind to run away. And she wasn't even unhappy at the time, so she gathers most of the neighbors and they all go searching for her until 2 a.m. and she is nowhere to be found. Once they get back, one of the neighbors informed the mom earlier that she had seen Carol walking up the street with the bag full of things, which only indicates that she was taken as she was walking back to her house. Carol's mom tried contacting the police for 6 days and there were no help. So on May 1st, on Route I-295, police ended up coming across the body of Carol. It was reported that she had bruises and cuts all over her body, and her cause of death was strangulation.
It all could have been prevented if the police just did their job right away.
I totally understand like the 24 hour thing, but it's also kind of a crappy situation, because what if within those 24 hours they could prevent it? And so like, I understand like why, because maybe like, you know, sometimes kids do run away, or some kids will show up within the next couple hours, but still like, I feel like there should be some kind of way you can bend that rule, because you never know how many lives could be saved, you know, and or how many people could be found within those 24 hours.
But police noticed that Carol was fully dressed, but both of her shoes were missing. So at this time, the homicide detectives arrive at Carol's home and break the sad news to her family that her body was found. Obviously, the family was devastated, as anyone should, but as the detectives got further into the case, a coroner report was released stating that Carol had suffered tons of brute force on her face, hands, and legs. But the oddest things police found was that there was food in her stomach that was undigested. So detectives believe that she was still alive and was murdered on that day when she was found. We should also point out that during this time, Washington, D.C. was full of protests. So a lot of out-of-state people were present in D.C., which only makes the search for the killer more difficult. But Carol's case was pushed to the side for 2 months until July 1971, when 16-year-old Darlena Johnson was leaving her home to go to her job, which she would never arrive to. Darlena's mother got a call from her job asking if Darlena was going to show up to work today because she hadn't arrived. Her mother found this very strange, so she goes and tries to look for her and had no luck. So she calls the police to report her missing. There was one witness though that stated that she had seen Darlena in a black car being driven by an African-American male, but that didn't really help much because she didn't know the make of the car and she didn't know the license plate either.
Now weeks go by with no answers from the police, but what was weird was that during this time, Darlena's mother was getting tons of phone calls from an number, and when she would pick up, nobody would say anything, and all you could hear is someone breathing in the phone. Darlena's mother said that she had a feeling that this was her daughter on the other line and she was kidnapped by someone, and they were doing this to let her know that she is still alive. She tells the police this, and they tell her that she needed proof in order to have them look into it. So once again, no help. But one night she was about to lay down, the phone rang, and a man with a deep voice says, in quotes, "I killed your daughter," and then hung up the phone. After this, she calls the police and notifies them about the call, but due to the lack of technology and resources in the time, they weren't able to track down like where the call was coming from, so the police weren't able to do much. But a couple days after Darlena's mother got the call, the police department receives one, but with an anonymous caller saying, in quote, "I believe there is a body alongside the I-295 freeway," and hangs up. So that's like the same freeway that, you know, Carol was found.
A few days after the phone call, on July 19, 1971, as a police officer is driving on the I-295, he spots something on the side of the road, so he pulls over and comes across the body of Darlena. It was reported that her body was fully dressed with bruises and fractured all over her, but once again, both of her shoes were missing. Investigators would later find out that her body had been there for about 15 days, which was the day Darlena's mom received the mysterious phone call. But due to the body being badly decomposed, they were unable to confirm the cause of the death, but there were signs of strangulation. This is when police officers believe that the anonymous caller was the killer, because only that person would have known that her body was there. So they began to look into it, but once again, like we said, due to the lack of technology, they were unable to trace that call. But on July 27, 1971, just 8 days after Darlena's body was found, 10-year-old Brenda Crockett was asked by her mother to go to the grocery store to pick up a few things. This grocery store was only a block away from their home, but when Brenda was gone for over an hour or so, the family started to worry. Her mom ends up leaving the house to go look for her, but after a few minutes, the phone rings back at home, and Brenda's 7-year-old sister picks it up, and it was Brenda on the other line.
Her sister said that Brenda was crying crying and said in quotes, "A white man took me and I'm being sent home in a cab." And then the call cuts off. A couple minutes after the phone rings, and this time Brenda's stepfather picks up the phone because he just got home. He starts asking her where she is and all that, and Brenda replies back saying she thinks she's somewhere in Virginia. And then she asks her stepdad, "Did my mom see me?" And at this point her dad is confused, so he asks Brenda if he can put the man who's bringing her home on the phone, and as reported, all he could hear was heavy footsteps walking towards the phone, and then the call ends. So Brenda's parents spent all night looking for her and calling the police, but they didn't have any luck. The following morning, a hitchhiker was walking along the Route of 50 freeway. He came across the body of 10-year-old Brenda. When police came, they reported that she was fully dressed, had lots of bruises, and both of her shoes were also missing. Now this is showing a pattern. This is when the police knew that they were dealing with a serial killer. So once the news broke out, families were freaking out, as they should, and they grew angry with the police for letting it get out of hand.
Weeks passed by and there was still no answer or progress on these cases. So far, all the victims that we know of this serial killer are all young Black African American girls, and there were other similar homicide cases that had to do with white children which were solved very quickly. So it just seemed like the cases of these innocent girls wasn't the top priority for the police department. Fast forwarding to October 1st, though, 1971, 12-year-old, this one's gonna be kind of hard for me to say, but it's Nina Moshia Yates, was asked by her father if she would go to the store to pick up a few things for dinner. The store was a block away from their home, and it wasn't that long of a walk. Nina Moisha was entering the store and leaving the store, but sadly, she never came back home. Like the other cases, the family ran out to go look for her, reported it to police, but no action was being taken by them. So 3 hours go by, and on Route 4, Nina Moisha's body was found alongside the road, same as the other girls. She was fully dressed, she was sexually assaulted, and had bruises all over her body, but once again, both of her shoes were missing. This time, investigators found a green fiber on her clothes, and there was also one witness who said that she saw her being forced to get into a blue Volkswagen.
And I couldn't even imagine. I mean, this is the 70s, of course, so like, yeah. It's really scary because, like, we always mention on this podcast, like, serial killers were a big thing during the 70s and 80s, you know?
They were all, like, active during this, like, decade, which is scary.
And I think that's, and of course, because, like, okay, side note, we watched this movie called Totally Killer, where it's based in the 80s, I believe. Mm-hmm. And when she comes back, like, she had, like, this little piece of DNA from the killer, and she brings it to them. They're like, "What are we supposed to do with this?" They're like, "Run it, you know, run the DNA." They're like, "We don't have the technology for that." So they just throw it on the ground. They started asking him, like, "Okay, now give me some real clues," you know? Yeah. So I feel like that's kind of how it was in that time, because, of course, they didn't have the technology to run things the way we do now. So I feel like it would have been so stressful to live in that time, because, like, this guy is going all crazy. But you think during that time, when they, like, reported it saying that she was missing, you think the police would have been on it, because they already know that a serial killer's on the loose.
I was also going to say, you think parents would also be, like, not sending their kids out by themselves to go get groceries and stuff. But then again, it was like the 70s. I feel like people were just so like they left their doors unlocked,
they were laid
their
back.
Cars, you know, like they would let their kids outside play with their neighbors like 3 houses down. Yeah. And it's like they were living so freely.
Yeah.
So it was easy for these kind of like
things
sick people to just be running around kidnapping kids or murdering people.
But this is when they named the killer the Freeway Phantom, because all of these bodies were being found on freeways near or in the I-295 freeway. And at this point, the FBI finally takes over the case, which is like about time, right? But they pinpoint that all the victims had been strangled, had their shoes missing, and the green fiber was found in Miss Nate's body and was also found on the other bodies. So like we said, this was one of DC's first ever serial killers, so they didn't know how to deal with this. The following month, on November 16th, 1971, the body of 18-year-old Brenda Woodward was spotted on the freeway ramp of the Baltimore-Washington Parkway. She was stabbed multiple times and also strangled. She was fully dressed, but she still had her shoes on. When her body was found, there was a red coat that was placed on top of her chest, which detectives would later find a handwritten note inside the front pocket. And this was a message to the police, which said in quotes, "This is a tantamount to my insensitivity to people, especially women. I will admit the others when you catch me if you can. The Freeway Phantom." They took the note and did research on it, and they would later find out that the handwriting matched Brenda Woodward's writing. So it was believed she was forced to write this for the killer before she was murdered.
At this point, investigators had no leads aside from the green fiber found on the bodies. 10 months end up going by, and they thought that the killer just had stopped because there wasn't any bodies showing up on the freeways. But on September 5th, 1972, Diane Williams was visiting her boyfriend that evening, and after hanging out with them, she had taken the bus bus back home. So her boyfriend walked her over to the bus stop. He hugged her, said goodbye, and watched her go inside the bus and leave. Sadly, Diane never made it back home. Her boyfriend was very worried because she usually calls him when she gets back home, but she didn't. So he called her phone and there was no answer. He ends up reporting this to the police and they didn't take it seriously. The family of Diane would report to the police that their daughter hadn't come home and it was already 1 a.m. Police informed the family that she had to be missing for 24 hours to be considered a missing person. Unfortunately, 3 hours later on freeway I-295, her body was found by the police. Her body was fully dressed, she was strangled, and both of her shoes were missing. Along with this, the green fiber was also found on her clothing. So it just seems like at this point, this killer is just quickly murdering these people. Before, he'd have them, like, whatever he was doing, like, torture them and stuff for, like, 3-4 days and then they would appear, but it's like
within hours.
This is within hours now,
which is scary. Like, I don't even know, but the FBI ended up looking into the list of suspects in or nearby Washington DC, and they stumbled across a gang called the Green Vega Rapists. These people would kidnap and rape victims in the DC area, so they arrested some of the members and questioned them. They ended up telling them that there was this guy, a lord in prison, who might be able to help them with the case. So they went to question this inmate and he agreed to talk only if they kept him anonymous and they helped him lower his sentence. So investigators agreed, and after asking him questions, they found him credible. They ended up taking him out on a few rides to see if he knew where the victims were found. The inmate described the clothes the victims were wearing and what spots they were found at, but there were some inconsistencies in his story that made investigators double think. So they take him on a second ride along, and as they are driving to the spot, the inmate ends up hearing on the radio one of the candidates announce that he was running for president, and that an inmate at Lorton Prison had given him information in order for him to help crack the case because he was supposedly heavy on crime.
Once the inmate heard this, though, he starts freaking out, and he would later decline any interviews and questions that authorities had for him. Afterwards, they didn't think that the Green Vegas had anything to do with it, because not only did the guy not provide solid information, but the gang formed in 1972, which was a year after the crimes had taken place. So they then start looking into a man named Robert Askins, a 58-year-old who was a computer technician that had been arrested for abducting and assaulting a 24-year-old woman in Washington. What was interesting about Robert was that he had one of his victims write a note just like one of the ones found in Brenda's coat, and that he also used the word tantamount a lot, so a search warrant was issued against Robert, but no evidence was found to link him to the murders. He would later pass away in the 90s in a federal prison because he was arrested and linked to 2 abductions and rapes in the early 1970s, but he denied being responsible for the freeway phantom killings. Police then start looking into 2 police officers who were arrested for the murder of 14-year-old Angela Barnes, who was assaulted and strangled, but she was not linked to the serial killer, but was found nearby I-295 freeway.
So the case basically went cold until 1987, when the new sergeant took over the department and began to work on cold cases. She ends up looking into a freeway phantom case and starts looking through everything and ends up finding out that a lot of the paperwork and other evidence had been destroyed and tampered with. The fibers were missing, objects and other important stuff were nowhere to be found, even the red coat was gone. Basically, all physical evidence had disappeared. So does this mean that the killer was inside the department, and was he able to get his hands on the evidence and possibly destroy it, or was there a bigger cover-up here? This sergeant ends up calling the FBI, the coroner's office, and meets with the families of the victims. After gathering more evidence, unfortunately there wasn't enough to rebuild the case. So without physical evidence, she ends up getting investigators back on the case, but she would later retire and the case would go cold once again. To this day, the freeway phantom killer was never caught and will forever remain a mystery.
What I find very interesting is how after when she got hired, all this physical stuff was gone, like physical evidence. So it really does make you think if it was somebody, not even just a police officer, but somebody in the department who got rid of all these things just in case, you know, later down the line they have the technology to run these things and then link them to that, to him or to her, you know?
Cold cases make me so angry. Like, you know, the unsolved cases on Netflix?
Yeah.
Oh my god. It just makes you like mad because you're like, why can't it, like, it just sucks that nobody can solve this.
What do you think, like, with this case? Do you think it was somebody in the department, or you think maybe some of the evidence got lost throughout the years? Maybe misplaced or something?
No, I don't think so, because if you think about it, all evidence to any kind of case is locked away in a safe place, and they're kind of like, how could this have gotten lost? I mean, like, if you think of like the Tupac case, a lot of that evidence was locked away.
Yeah,
not a lot of it went missing,
especially on high profile cases like this.
Yeah,
things are kept safe.
Exactly. So I think that somebody tampered with it, and I definitely think that it could have been someone in the department. It's definitely somebody who had the ability to hide this.
But also the Prince George County Police are still trying to solve this case. So if you or anybody you know might have information, please call the Prince George County Police Department at 866-411-TIPS. And do you think this person could still be out there? It was in the 70s.
Yeah. So if it's in the 70s, say this person was at least 30 to 36. That was about 30 years ago. So now they're about 66. So, I mean, if they took care of themselves or whatever, yeah.
They're probably still alive. That's scary. Still alive.
Yeah. They're either in their late 50s, late 60s, depending. I mean, I don't know why. I just have a feeling this is like someone in their late 30s.
Somebody in their late 30s,
yeah.
Back then?
Yeah, back then, yeah.
So, yeah, so they would be 67. Yeah, 60s, yeah. Close to the 70s.
Yeah.
That is scary to think that this person could actually still be out there.
If not, maybe he's locked up for like a completely different crime, but yeah. I definitely think that it's crazy when you put it into perspective like that.
Yeah, but we want to thank you guys for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and follow us on all social media pages at the Scaredy Cats Podcast, and that's Scaredy Cats with the K. Also, if you enjoyed today's episode, leave us a review letting us know what you guys loved about it. We would really appreciate it.
And also, don't forget, we will be at the Magic Valley Mall in Twin Falls, Idaho on October 28th at 1 p.m. for the live podcast event of Robert the Doll.
Yes, so if you guys live nearby the area, definitely check it out. Like we said, stay tuned for the link. We'll post it on our social media pages and update it here on the podcast description as well, so you guys can reserve your seats. And you know, we're just super excited to be able to do our very first live event.
But without further ado, we are out.
Peace.